Architecture Talks, the podcast about architecture from Jung.
Let's begin with three word pairs, Stephen. What do you prefer, gut feeling or Excel spreadsheet?
I think if you're talking about feelings, about intuition, intuition's a little bit underestimated in the field of architecture because the whole of your life, you pick up certain influences and they all, you know, formulate into ideas in your head and you have then a certain sort of attitude, a certain positioning when it comes to either solving problems or certain points of view. I think intuition is actually probably one of the most important things in what we do as architects. And I think that's a little bit underestimated because everybody talks about, you know, process, which is completely fine. But intuition is something which isn't really talked about in terms of this, you know, learning process, in terms about, you know, developing ideas and projects. So I think gut feeling is actually for us and what we do in the office, for me personally, is very, very important.
Luxury or IKEA?
I think when you talk about luxury, it's actually a word which has never really appealed to me because it means something which is not really that necessary. You can see it in a lot of luxury brands. There's actually, you don't really have to have these products. You don't really have to get involved in that kind of world. I think if you're trying to use the word luxury, I'd rather use the word premium because I think, you know, premium is something which has a certain quality, but it's not so much that it's actually alienating a lot of other people. I think this idea about luxury, inequality, premium is actually things which have been going around in my head for quite a while now. I think, you know, premium is really achievable. And if you're talking about furniture manufacturers which are doing flat packs where you can build your own furniture, actually done, designed by very good designers. And IKEA makes incredible products and you can really combine them in all sorts of interiors. And I'm a really big fan of it. And I think also this idea of this Northern European democratic kind of standpoint, which really appeals to me as well, which I think is actually becoming more and more prevalent. Design and architecture is this idea that we're all together in terms of social structures, something which has been lost in the last period of time, that it's really a you society, everybody fighting for themselves, and this idea of a collective good has actually been lost. But then again, you've got companies who are still fighting, like IKEA, to actually make a very democratic product that almost everybody can afford. I used to have IKEA things. I think they're probably in the cellar because you don't throw them away. I actually started taking them apart in the hope that I could put them back together again one day, but we will see if that's possible.
Fish buns or scones?
Those fish sandwiches which you get in Northern Europe. Yeah. Yeah, I've never really liked those, actually, to be honest. You know, I've been living in Hamburg for almost 30 years and it's the longest I've ever lived anywhere. And everybody comes to Hamburg and they want to go down to the harbor and have this fish brooch. And yeah, it's always a really big thing. And cold fish has never really appealed to me in that way. But it's a part of the culture.
So rather the scones.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, being British is actually really quite a strong identity. Well, up until the Brexit problematic, it was actually a pretty good brand being from Great Britain. And obviously, in the last 4 or 5 years, it's actually, people feel sorry for me when I check into a hotel with my British passport. So I normally use my German one when I check in to avoid any kind of embarrassment.
So you feel more welcome.
Yeah. Yeah, because I don't really need those unnecessary conversations about, you know, being British. So I think the scones thing is actually really quite interesting because it's all about certain values and etiquette. If you go to hotels in London in the afternoon and you have scones and tea, it's actually very, very civilized. And I think that's a part of Great Britain, which I really do like, this idea that it's a civilized society. And then you go out onto the street and you see how chaotic it is and obviously a little bit different. But I think these ideas of tradition are really quite important. Equally for Hamburg, having your fish sandwiches and your scones from the UK, that's actually makes it really interesting when you travel around. There's also another dish as well. It's called Labskaus, which is chopped meat with a herring on top with an egg and beetroot chopped into it as well.
Nicole, you are laughing. You know that?
Yeah, I know that.
I've never heard about it.
I also live in Hamburg, but I don't like that. Normally, as you live in Hamburg, you have to eat it some days, but I don't like it.
Well, we would like to introduce you as well, Stephen. Architecture in cities are created through dialogue, exchange, and a critical process translated into space, function, and form. The process is not dependent on aesthetics, but rather on the creation of meaningful places to which people can relate and belong. Inspirational architecture combined with social responsibility to create better places as a win for economies, cities, and their populations. Is this the key for overseeing the transformation of society? Stephen Williams says, let's start with better concepts for how we want to live our lives. Rethink design as social design. How do we do that? That's what we, Katrina and Nicole, will be talking about today with Stephen Williams in our podcast. Nice to have you with us, Stephen.
Thank you very much for the invitation. And it's interesting what you're saying about actually making cities more livable. It's really about placemaking. It's really giving people a reason to go to certain places in the city. And you know, what we're looking for as designers, as architects, is really how do you achieve genuine communication between people? How do you bring people together? You know, what are the components which you need in terms of urbanism or in terms of a building or in terms of activities within a building to bring people together? First of all, in terms of urban placemaking, you have to look at the components which bring people together in certain urban spaces where the uses within and around those spaces are something which is actually attractive and useful for the people who are going to inhabit those spaces and actually what happens within those buildings as well. There was an example which we did in Hamburg, which we started in 2008, which was called the Stadthofer, where we took a part of the city which was 100 years old, which nobody knew because it used to be the local authority buildings, and then opened it up to the whole of the city, a total of 75,000 square meters where people could explore courtyards and urban situations which never really existed, or people didn't know that these spaces existed. And in combination with that, we designed a boutique hotel, which is actually a really strong magnet to bring people in to eat, communicate, and exchange with each other. It works at all sorts of different levels, you know, at all sorts of communication levels, from an urbanism level to, you know, what are you providing in terms of attraction to get people into those spaces. So it's really reinventing the inner city. And within this project, we did 30,000 square meters of housing, shopping, offices. It's a completely mixed development in the Stadthofer. And it's been open since 2018, really proven that you can actually achieve sustainable regeneration within the city in terms of the activities which are currently happening in that area.
You build great projects, Stephen, in beautiful places, generally with large budgets, but you still want to improve them in terms of social design. What was missing, like, in the tasks you've completed so far, and why?
Well, nothing's really missing because the name of the office is Stephen Williams Associates and not architects or anything like that. So we get really quite interesting inquiries, which are not normal. Therefore, we've got a very wide range of tasks and very kind of exciting projects. You know, when you're talking about the social aims, you know, which we have as an office, when we were asked to do a Bugatti pavilion in the outer Stadt in Wolfsburg, that's as far away as you can get through inclusivity and democracy. And then we actually worked with an artist, Olaf Nikolai from Berlin, and we decided that we would take the Bugatti and get it mirrored so that when you looked at it, you would see yourself in this car. You know, when the visitors went into the pavilion, you know, they would see themselves.
It's awesome. That's really awesome.
And therefore, you kind of, you know, broke down, you know, this relationship of unobtainable and, you know, jealousies and all these really quite negative aspects about a car which is very, very expensive. And most of the people who see it will never, ever be able to drive one. And so therefore, you're working at all these different levels. And that was a very successful collaboration that you say, well, actually, you can take things which on the face of it are very commercial and really turn them around and get people on your side. And that's what we try with developers, because a lot of projects, there's an end investor, and all these people have to have their boxes ticked in the whole process, you know. And also what you're trying to do is, you know, the social aims of your projects as well are running parallel to all these themes. So there's not any kind of conflict between commercial aims and social aims if you actually get the concepts right. That's actually something which we found within our projects, which are sometimes incredibly commercial, but actually work at all sorts of cultural levels as well, whether it's a subversive kind of subculture or whether it's, you know, high culture.
I've seen a really beautiful statement on your Instagram account. Architecture is a way of reflecting society, human desire, and how we can add more joy, beauty, and creativity to our existence. How do you define architects' responsibility towards society?
Wow.
That's a tricky question.
No, it's actually a really good question because, you know, when I started studying back in the 1980s, there was a Great Britain and also in Germany, there was a boom in social housing, you know, where the city was, you know, building their own housing schemes. And we were taken around London looking at housing schemes, which were then from the 1960s and 70s, because that was really state of the art housing schemes, you know, walkways in the sky, concrete and all these kind of things. But it was a very heroic gesture where architects were, you know, really trying to help society and say, actually, you know, this is how people should live. You know, this is how communities can be built. And that's actually something which has always kind of stayed with me, this idea of social housing. And I think if you can solve the housing crisis, then you're doing an awful lot, you know, to bringing society further along. There's also other themes, education, whatever, but I can't influence that as much as I can in terms of design and architecture. And I think this idea of building for the common good in terms of, you know, social architecture, that's actually really fails at the moment. If you look at a city like Hamburg, 50% of the land is still owned by the city of Hamburg. You know, they own it. It's paid for by the taxpayers. I think, you know, to start selling off these parcels of land, which has been happening for an awful long time, giving them to private developers, saying 30% affordable housing, I'm not really quite sure if that's the way forward. I think that the city really should build on their sites affordable housing. And it's not about micro apartments, because as we know, they're even more expensive per square meter to rent out as normal size apartments. So that's actually a bit of a trick, which I don't like very much. But I think these social aims, I think, you know, the common good has really been lost in terms of the end investors, you know, looking for their margins, property developers. Globalized world at the moment, you're seeing the developers are getting larger, you know, the pension funds are getting larger. And there's not a lot of space in between in terms of an architect with a small office doing small jobs and these huge offices who are doing large jobs. There's really nothing in between. And I see that it's really heading in a way that these innovative medium-sized projects will cease to exist in a certain period of time because smaller offices don't achieve all the regulatory standards to even apply for these projects. And that's what I'm seeing at the moment. You know, the global players are really buying up everything and making it very, very difficult for true innovation in any form of, you know, the built environment, because you're, you know, really working for the pension funds or some real estate fund based some other part of the world, which is looking at the numbers. And so therefore, you know, it's really difficult to reconcile these financial aspects with the social aspects in terms of placemaking, the things we've talked about. It's actually a really fine juggle to achieve those. But it is possible. I mean, when we do certain projects, we can normally achieve our aims in terms of social impact to society, whether it's workspace design or something similar.
We found an interview where you said, as an architect, you have opportunities that a politician doesn't. What are those opportunities?
Well, yeah, because, you know, a politician, unless it's a dictatorship, isn't normally only in for 4 years or 8 years. And it's very, very difficult to change things within that short period of time. And if you build a building, it's normally there for a lot longer than that. Therefore, you have an enormous influence on the culture and the way people behave with the buildings which you design. There's a way of enlightenment. If you design a building where people come in every morning or they walk past it and the way the sun is shining on certain parts of it or the way the courtyard has a certain energy about it, that actually you can really improve the standard of people's lives. And I think that's something, if you've got the power to be able to do that, to improve people's lives, then you don't do it. It's almost criminal. So that therefore, you're sitting in my office every day going, how do we really get the most out of this design? You know, how do we make the people who are going to use this interior or interact with these buildings, give them this extra value? And that's then obviously mirrored in commercial aspects as well, because you can rent the building out for maybe more money because it's a better building. And so it all kind of hangs together, you know, that the aims, capitalist aims, don't generally prohibit social aspects of the design, actually. Sometimes they can augment a design and actually make it more successful because you've got more frequency or traffic coming to a location.
And exclusivity is a failed idea of yesterday. That was also one of your statements. The dream of uniqueness should be replaced in the favor of an inclusive, democratic approach. What do the hoteliers, the tech companies, and advertising agencies you work for say about that?
Yeah, sometimes you say things which are a little bit provocative.
Oh, really? I never heard you say anything provocative, Stephen.
You know, if you're walking along a street and you see a big sign outside and it says exclusive apartments, you know, to buy, it just means you can't afford it. And that's actually really quite sad. You know, if you're walking along and you see all these, you know, wonderful to rent, to buy exclusive, I just find it a little bit kind of repulsive. You know, what happened to inclusivity? What happened to that in the last period of time? And I think it's really got to be turned around. This idea of exclusive, I don't like it personally. But if you're working with brands which are, in a way, exclusive, you can subvert it as well because, you know, they work at all sorts of different levels, you know. When you've got artists designing training shoes, when you've got Paul Smith painting a car, you know, there's all sorts of kind of ways of making it into something else, which makes it very kind of palatable and a lot more accessible, because I think everybody should really have the chance to experience quality spaces. I mean, even if you're doing something, a project which is very, very small, like a pizzeria, which we did recently, and you walk in and you see the smiles on people's faces and they're ordering drinks and they're laughing and they're just so happy to be in this environment, which actually somebody curated, you know, which we curated this environment where these people can go wild. I mean, I've never seen a pizzeria which serves so many cocktails in my life as this one. They serve 300 or 400 cocktails a night and it's a pizzeria. And so that therefore, you know, you're kind of doing something right, making people feel as if they belong somewhere, you know. You come into a space and yeah, I understand, you know, and they order a cup of coffee and they can sit there and really take in the space, you know, for this €4. And that is completely democratic, even though the locations can be very exclusive, but they don't really exclude anybody. I've got a little anecdote. There's a Schumann's Tagesbar, I'm sure you know, in Munich, Schumann's Tagesbar, yeah? You know, half the seats are empty. It's 11 o'clock on a Saturday morning. And, you know, two people come in, obviously tourists, you know, with anoraks and umbrellas and stuff like that. And on the tables are reserved signs of all of the tables, you know, reserved. And then, you know, a man in his, you know, mid-50s, who's, you know, the maitre d', comes over and says, sorry, and shoulder going, you know, we're completely booked out. And then two young girls walk in and they can choose whatever table they want. And I just thought, well, actually, that's a bit unfair, you know. There's something about that which doesn't appeal to my socialist kind of tendencies, you know, because that is not inclusive. That's actually very undemocratic.
Exclusive.
Yeah, it's pretty exclusive. And I remember when I was a kid being really scared of walking in certain shops because you knew you couldn't afford it. And that's always kind of stayed with me. And that this kind of idea of, in German, it's called Hemmschwelle. In English, it's probably this fear of an environment where you don't really feel yourself, you know. And that's always kind of stayed with me. I said, how do you achieve through design, through intelligent design, spaces which are totally inclusive, you know, where people can walk in from any cultural level, any culture, you know, totally diverse spaces where everybody can communicate with each other on a certain level and, you know, building people up to that level where they're really excited in being in a certain place and happy to be able to share that environment.
Yeah, it's like including the design of an emotional level.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because there's a scientific area called semiotics, which is really about the brain analyzes within a millisecond thousands of different influences from lighting, acoustics, smell, you know, all these things. And your brain really develops a standpoint, you know, to where you are. It either makes you feel good or not so good or indecisive. And through design, these semiotic influence, you can actually change people's point of view through acoustic, through light, through materials. And so therefore, you've got this palette, thousands of different components, like a huge matrix, like a recording studio desk, where you can do all these things to really get what you want to achieve. And then in terms of workspace design, that's actually really quite interesting because people are working in an environment which is a part of a company which has got a certain brand values. How do you communicate those brand values in terms of materials when you come into an office? Is it a tech company? Is it a lawyer's office where you've got to communicate stability, substance? You know, is it an office where you have to communicate innovation? How do you do those in terms of spatial sequences and materials? That's actually really quite exciting, because every time you start off completely new, you know, with your palette of materials, with maybe buildings which are a little bit more difficult, or maybe you're building a building.
So we all live for the small wow moments in life. And what's better than discovering the unexpected? What surprises you and what inspires you?
Wow.
Yeah, the wow moment.
Three questions at a time. Wow.
What I find really exciting is the celebration of something which is completely normal in a way, that actually doesn't exceed your expectations, or it doesn't undersell itself. It's actually completely normal. I think a lot of planners, a lot of designers are trying to do things which are extraordinary, you know, completely extraordinary. You know, you come into a space and there's things hanging from the ceiling, you know, the floor comes up as some kind of pink blob, which, you know, represents something. And therefore, a lot of people are trying too hard. You know, you're sitting in a restaurant which is completely over-designed. It's actually quite stressful because you're looking around, you can't concentrate on your conversation. I'd rather go somewhere which is completely normal. I think, you know, the conversations are better if you're not challenged by space. I think this, you know, challenging people through space is obviously interesting. You've got to do it in a really clever way, and that you don't, you know, dominate a conversation in a restaurant. If you're going out, you know, two people in a restaurant, which is completely over-designed, spend half your time talking about the restaurant design, which is not really that exciting. You should be talking about other stuff.
We would like to jump into your past, Stephen. Your collaboration with Malcolm McLaren, a British artist, fashion designer, music manager, and musician. He said, rock and roll doesn't necessarily mean a band. It doesn't mean a singer, and it doesn't mean lyrics, really. It's that question of trying to be immortal. We would really like to know, what is your rock and roll?
I think you got to get the context. I met Malcolm in Hamburg back in the 90s, and he happened to be standing outside my office, which was actually really quite weird. There's a cafe under my office as well, and I came out and I saw him and I recognized him. I said, Malcolm, what are you doing here in Hamburg? And he was with a woman from MTV. He was doing some interviews. And he said he was really hungry, and the restaurant didn't serve him because it was after 9 o'clock at night. So I took him back in and explained who he was. And they opened up the kitchen and they made him a meal, which was really very, very cool. And then we had a nice little chat. And then he phoned me the next day and said, are you free? Because I don't have this lady from MTV anymore. I'm free to go out and talk about some other things. And then went out for dinner. And we was ended up spending the whole time talking about the French situationists, Guy Debord, and the late 60s kind of protagonists who really were trying to change a culture, not through art and painting, but actually through using people as their canvas. There's actually something which, for me and for him as well, was actually a huge influence. You know, when I was growing up in the 70s and seeing the bands which were coming through, the Pistols, which were completely curated by Vivian Westwood and Malcolm, to go out and cause a huge amount of chaos, and were actually incredibly successful in doing that and really changed the culture in terms of music and fashion. And the influences from somebody like Malcolm McLaren still resonate through the culture. A lot of the people which I work with in their late 50s or mid 50s, early 50s were originally subversive characters, and these people are now the head of multinational corporations. So that therefore you're working at a completely different level. They really understand how subculture starts off and becomes high culture. And that's actually really quite exciting, that you can take something which is originally a little bit subversive and really turn it around and make it something which everybody can associate with.
What is your own rock and roll?
Well, I remember once, it was really sad when I heard Universal Music were leaving Hamburg to move to Berlin in about 99 or 2000. I thought, that's really very, very sad. And then I got introduced to a couple of people who were in charge of Universal Music. And so I pitched to do the interior, some of the interior, not all of it, for Universal Music. And then after I won that job, I was having a drink in a bar and phoned my friend Murph, dropped in and had a drink. And I said, hey, Murph, I just got signed by Universal. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, yeah, you know, to do their new offices, because he knew I wasn't a very good singer. That was actually one of these moments in time where you never forget. And I think everybody lives for moments. I think actually the more I do what I do, it's all these, you know, moments when you check into a hotel in Taipei and the first thing you do is put your bag on the bed and go up and check the rooftop bar because you know it's going to be really cool. You know, those are the kind of moments, and those moments are curated by somebody who planned it, somebody who had a story, somebody who really understood how to get people excited. And that's actually something which I'm really happy about when you say, you know, what surprises me. It's not that I'm surprised. I'm actually pleasantly reassured that actually these things still exist, that people do take it seriously. So that therefore, if you go into places which have actually been thought about, actually makes me very, very happy.
The emotional level.
Yeah, because everything communicates something. And you can see why you've got so many social issues in cities because of bad urbanism. And you can see that in certain German cities, which were reconstructed in the 50s and 60s. It's understandable. There isn't any potential for the young people. It's really understandable, these social issues. It really stems from the urbanism, that there really aren't spaces which inspire people.
Stephen, thank you so much for sharing your time with us and your thoughts. It was really great. And to all our listeners, we look forward to sharing our upcoming Jung Architecture Talks podcast with you. Stay tuned on jung.de podcast.